Bangalore, and he's going to tell us about polymer parameterized field theory. Just for the general audience, the recent developments in this area may be very useful for us to see how Lorentz invariance could be restored in the polymer quantization kind of ideas. So, Alok, please go ahead.
Thanks a lot. So, I'm going to talk about a very, very simple system. It's a two-dimensional, massless, free scalar field theory on a cylinder. And hopefully I'll be able to convince you by the end of this talk that it's a very good solved model for loop quantum gravity. So we move on to slide 2, motivation. So I guess we all agree that the major open issues in LQG are satisfactory definition of Hamiltonian constraints and the issue of observables and the emergence of classical limits. There's a related question in that we know that quantum geometry is in a precise and it's discrete at the kinematical level. But if you solve, once you solve the constraints, what is the sense in which this discreteness manifests itself? And also, if indeed if the underlying theory is discrete in some suitable sense, then how does a continuum classical GRs emerge from it? So our main motivation behind this work is that if you look at simple generally covariant quantum field theories, then it can help elucidate some of these issues. We move on to slide 3. So as I said, we look at a very simple system. It's a free massless scalar field theory on a flat cylinder, S1 cross R. The phi here is the scalar field. X plus and X minus are the light cone, usual light cone coordinates, and eta is the flat metric, Minkowski-Kelle metric. Now, a free field on a cylinder, it splits into three components. One is the zero mode, which is just a point particle degree of freedom. And then there is one component which only depends on X plus coordinate. We call it the right mover. And there is a component which depends only on the X minus coordinate, and we call it the left mover. Next slide, please. Now, when you want to do canonical analysis of the theory, we know that we have to choose a one-parameter family of states like embedding. And at each fixed parameter time small t, x plus of x and x minus of x define a space-like embedding of a circle into a flat cylinder. Here, small x is just the angular coordinate. Now, if you look at the, usually we quantize the phase space with a configuration variable and a momenta conjugate to it. But in this case, there are for reasons that will be clear, there are better choice of coordinates, and they are as follows. So if you forget about the zero mode, then just look at the initial data for the right mover and the initial data for the left mover, and we will call them y plus of x and y minus of x. And these are the coordinates we will use, and for the following reason. If you look at the polling bucket between y plus and y minus, it's exactly zero. So they mutually commute with each other. And if you look at the Hamiltonian, it's clear that dynamically they don't mix. So if you forget about the zero mode, these two components don't talk to each other. And we know that this chain is obviously not generally covariant because the metric is fixed. Next slide, please. Now here's how we make this chain generally covariant. So all we do is we extend the phase space. So we add to our y plus and y minus the new dynamical variables, which are nothing but the state-like embeddings themselves, x plus of x and x minus of x, and momenta conjugate to them, which I will call phi plus and phi minus. The theory that we get from this extension is known as parameterized field theory, and I will argue that this theory is indeed generally covariant. So we know in ordinary field theory we work on a fixed foliation, but now we can see because we have made the embeddings dynamical, all foliations are allowed in parameterized field theory. But we know that physics, finally, because it's just a massless scale of field theory in a cylinder, physics, that is solutions to equation of motion, are independent of choice of foliation. So clearly that's some gauge freedom in our theory now. Next slide. But if you look at canonical gravity, we know that general covariance is nothing but choice of foliation. So that tells us that this gauge is nothing but general covariance. And general covariance in two dimensions means that our theory has two first-class constraints and no true Hamiltonian. And there are a couple of points to note here. One is that we added two extra fields to our phase space, x plus and x minus. But we have two first-class constraints. So that tells us that these fields are just pure gauge. And we haven't changed anything physically. The physical content of this theory is still just massless scalar field theory in a cylinder. And another important point to note for the rest of the talk is that x plus and x minus play a dual role in the theory. That is, on one hand, they are the light cone coordinates on the cylinder, but also at the same time they are dynamical fields which define a space like embedding of a circle into a cylinder. Next slide. Now there are two constraints which I will call H plus and H minus. What is important is the constraint algebra. So if you look at the constraint algebra, you notice a couple of things. One is that it's a truly algebra. There are no structure functions. And this is one of the main reasons why this model is so tractable. The other point to note is that H plus constraint commutes with the H minus constraint. And the whole constraint algebra is actually homomorphic to the algebra of diffeomorphisms on a surface. So it's very tempting to think that the flows that these constraints generate will be nothing but spatial diffeomorphism on a surface. And this is true for all the fields except the embedding fields. The reason being that the embedding fields are not periodic. So they satisfy some quasi-periodic conditions which I have written down below. This is a very important point which I will come to, which I will elaborate on as we go along in this talk. Next slide. So there are two interpretations to the flows that these constraints generate. Let's just look at the plus constraint because, as I said, plus and minus, they don't talk to each other. So we'll just focus on the plus constraint. So one interpretation is familiar from canonical gravity itself. So given a space like embedding x plus of x and x minus of x, what H plus will do is it will just evolve into a new embedding, which let's say it's X plus some infinitesimal change and X minus, and it evolves Y plus by just the scalar field Hamiltonian, which is the true Hamiltonian of the matter field, and keeps Y minus unchanged. There is another interpretation which is very specific to this model and which will be very important for us, which is the following. So N plus, which is the Lagrange multiplier for the constraint, it's just a vector field on S1. So We can think of it also as a periodic vector field on R. And what you do is take your, so consider all the fields that we have, and instead of thinking of them as fields on a circle, think of them as fields on a real line. Then it can be shown that the gauge transformation generated by H plus on the plus fields can be interpreted as action of just a periodic diffeomorphism generated by the vector field N plus. And by periodic diffeomorphism, all I mean is, if it size your periodic diffeomorphism, and if it takes a point x on real line to point y, then it will take x plus 2pi to y plus 2pi. Again, let me emphasize that this interpretation for the y plus field and the pi plus field is same as spatial diffeomorphism on the circle, but only for the x plus field, it's not a diffeomorphism on the circle, but it's a periodic diffeomorphism on this real line. And next slide. So the gauge transformations are essentially spatial diffeomorphism, which means that if you integrate any scalar density, you will get an observable in the theory. So if you take your matter field, say y plus of it, and if you just smear it with an embedding dependent function f, then it's a scalar, and if you integrate it, then it's an observable. For example, if for the capital F, if you take just a plane wave, e to the in x plus, then you just get the Fourier modes, an and an star. And we know that, as I said earlier, the physical content of this field is just that of massless free scalar fields here in a cylinder. So we know that these Fourier modes are really the true degree of freedom of this field. So in the framework of PFT, we have a complete set of observables. So we have a generally covariant field theory where the constraint algebra is a truly algebra, and this is a specific feature of two dimensions, and we have a complete set of observables. Next slide. There are also a global symmetries in a theory. So again, because it's just a free field theory essentially, we know it's Poincaré invariant. But because we are on a cylinder, there are no boosts, we only have translations. And all they do is just translate x plus and x minus. And because x plus and x minus are fields now in parametric field theory, they will just translate these embedding fields. So all they do is, if you look at the fields x plus of small x and x minus of x, then they just translate it by some p number parameters, delta of plus and delta of minus. And what can be shown is that these canonical transformations commute with the flow generated by the constraint. So in that sense, they are the global symmetries of the theory. They all they do is map solutions to solutions. In fact, as the scalar field is massless, actually the full symmetric group is the conformal group. But as you will see, only the Poincaré symmetries will survive in the quantum theory once we do quantize this theory. Next slide. So now we come to that basically completes the framework for classical theory. Now we look at how to loop quantize this theory. We will only focus on the right moving sector, and I mentioned left moving sector only at important points. And I'll proceed by analogy with LPG at every step. So because we are in spatial dimension 1, we know that scalar density is same as one form, and densitized vector field is same as scalar. So So the pi plus and y plus is, are one form of the circle, and they are analogous to the connection in MQTT. And x plus, which is just a scalar, is analogous to a densitized triad. And n plus, which is a Lagrange multiplier for the constraint, is a vector field, and that's analogous to the shift vector. Next slide. So we know in MQTT what are elementary variables. They are just cylindrical functions for the connection, and the flux is for the triad. So what we have to do, we have to choose analog of cylindrical functions for pi plus and y plus, and analog of fluxes for x plus. And these are going to be our elementary variables. So first we choose a graph, which is nothing but a finite collection of float intervals on the surface. And for pi plus, the elementary variable, the analog of cylindrical function is what I call s, and it's written there. And similarly for y plus, the cylindrical function is g. And the analog of flux for x plus, because so remember for flux what we do is we take our densitized triad and we smear it along a sub-manifold of four-dimension one, which in this case is just a point. So analog of flux variable is just x plus itself, the field itself. Next slide. Now one of the requirements in choosing elementary variables is that they should separate a quantum field space. And it turns out that it can be shown that for this the charges KE and LE, which were there for the cylindrical functions, they do not have to be real. It suffices to take them as integers. But these are dimensionful. So what we have to do is to choose some a scale, which I will call A for the charge A and epsilon for the charge L. And both the scale will be integral multiple of A and L will be integral multiple of epsilon. These are, in some sense, they are analog of emergency parameters because gravity we know is independent of emergency parameter, but they go in the definition of the algebra that is the quantized in LCD. In the same way here, our theory to begin with, the classical theory is independent of these parameters, but they have been put in the definition of the algebra that we will eventually quantize. And there's just a technicality that this A, we take it to be of specific form 2 pi by and it's large integer. So from now on, we'll see why. We will refer to these KEs as embedding charges and LEs as matter charges. Next slide. Now, one could say the basic principle underlying loop quantization is as follows. Suppose you are given some generally covariant Hamiltonian system, and such that it has a subalgebra which is a truly algebra. Then the elementary variables that we quantize, usually we choose, are such that they behave covariantly under this subalgebra. So obviously in LQG, the subalgebra is the algebra generated by the diffeomorphism constraint, and we choose the variables which behave covariantly under spatial diffeomorphism. But in our case, the entire algebra is a two-LG algebra. So our elementary variables should be such that they are covariant with respect to all the constraints. And as you will see, this is almost the case. Not quite, but it's almost the case. Next slide. So again, let's say that the finite transformations which are generated by the two constraints are phi plus and phi minus. And as I argued before, you can think of them as periodic diffeomorphisms on the real line. And as far as all the fields except the x plus and x minus go, they are just diffeomorphisms on the surface. And I will denote the action of these gate transformations on our elementary variables by alpha. And so what alpha does to, for example, the elementary variable f, is just that it just moves the graph around, exactly like what spatial diffeomorphisms do in LQG. And same on the variable g, it just moves the graph around. But on x plus, if you see the action, x plus don't behave covariantly under this transformation. There's a VR factor of 2 pi m which gets added, which I will explain on the next slide. And again, because the minus factor doesn't really talk to the plus factor, the pi minus transformations will act trivially on the plus factor. Next slide. So here's how we understand the 2 pi m factor. Take a real line and split it into closed intervals of length 2 pi. And suppose the point x is lying between 0 and 2 pi, and suppose pi plus is a diffeomorphism, a periodic diffeomorphism on R, which maps x to a point y, which lies between 2 pi m and 2 pi m plus 1, then this factor of 2 pi m will get added to when we transform x plus. Next slide. Now let's look at what is the representation. So what we want to do is exactly what we do in LQG. We want to find a faithful representation of the algebra generated by the elementary variables, which also should carry unitary representation of the gauge group. So in LQG, we know that there's a canonical choice of orthonormal basis, which is given by spin network basis, which has a graph, and on each edge we have a SU2 representation, and on each vertex we have an intertwiner. there is a corresponding basis for parametric field theory, which is given by the graph, which is a graph on a circle now. This is a collection of closed intervals on the circle. And on each edge, we put two charges, KE and LE. And we choose a similar basis for the minus vector. But I will only talk about the plus vector mainly. But the full kinematical Hilbert space is just a tensor product of the plus Hilbert space and the minus Hilbert space. Although something important to note, which we will use later on, is that because our states implicitly depend on the two parameters, we don't have a single Hilbert space, but we have a two parameter family of Hilbert spaces. And we scan through all of them when we do some classical physics. We will see this later. Next slide. Now let's see how the, what are the operators corresponding to.
Can you slow down a little?
Hello?
Yeah. So, for this graph gamma, you take the original circle, graph leaves in the original circle, right? Not the embedded one. So this abstract circle which is sitting there. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then I can just take any decomposition of this original circle into intervals.
Yes.
These intervals are not regular or anything like that. I can just take any one.
Yes.
But you are assuming that it only contains a countable number of intervals?
Yes, countable, yes.
So you take any countable.
Finite number of intervals.
Okay, so you just divide into finite number of intervals. Okay.
Yes.
And the fact that you get all these different Hilbert spaces,
yes.
These Hilbert spaces corresponding to the units you have chosen, I already forgotten the name.
Epsilon and eight.
Yeah, epsilon and eight, okay. So those, that corresponds, these Hilbert spaces, I mean these representations of the kinematical algebra, are they all literally inequivalent?
Yes, they're all inequivalent.
Okay, so that is the sense in which it is completely analogous to what you were saying before, that one might want to think of them in some suitable sense as the analog of the immediacy parameter. Namely, for each value of the immediacy parameter, we get a representation of the kinematical algebra, and they're all inequivalent, and the situation here is similar. Is that right?
Exactly, yes.
Just speak a little bit slowly because I don't know, there is a lot of echo, but just noise, background noise on the phone when you speak, and then people in the room have difficulty in understanding some words. So try to speak a little more slowly if possible.
Okay, yes. So we are on the slide 18 right now. So recap that the elementary variables that we have are the F, the G's, and the X pluses. So let's say that gamma is some graph with an edge E. And so now let's look at the representation of these elementary variables. So let's focus on F. F is just some single edge. So we'll look at a graph which is just a single edge E. Now F hat of E, the action of F hat of E on the state that I wrote down, is exactly analogous to action of Voronoi. All it does, if this F hat is carrying a charge K, and then it will add the charge K to the corresponding edge in the state, K E. So it's exactly analogous to the action of the Voronoi operator. The action of G hat operator is slightly different. So what it does is, it to the charge L E, which is sitting on the edge E, it adds the charge L, but there's also a phase factor accompanying it. So if you want to draw analogy with L to G, it is like if you take an exponential of flux times the Voronoi operator, and if you act it on a spin network state, you will get a phase factor times the spin network. This is exactly analogous to that. And suppose you have a point x naught in your HE, then the x hat of plus of x naught acting on this state is going to just pick out the corresponding k value from the edge. So it's exactly like a flux operator, which picks out the j values. So it's analogous to the action of the flux operator. Next slide. Now there are certain things we can notice. One is that just like in L2G, the connection is not a well-defined operator. Here, y plus and pi plus are not well-defined operators, only their exponentials are. And the states, S plus, are eigenstates of the embedding operator. Just like in L2G, the spin networks are eigenstates of the flux operator. And so we, in analogy with spin networks, we call these guys charge network states. Also notice that the data KE, the sequence KE, is like a quantum counterpart, because these are eigenvalues of the embedding operator. It's like a quantum counterpart of classical embedding fit X plus of X. And this, because of this, there is a very nice space-time picture. If you take a charge network for the plus sector and tensor with, it with a charge network for the minus sector, then this is a very nice space-time picture for it. We'll see how this plays a very important role for understanding the model later on. So next slide. So the above picture is like is exactly what a charge network is on a circle, where you have a countable number of edges and you have a pair of charges sitting on each edge. But if you look at, there is a space-time picture for it, which is if you take the embedding values, say k1 plus and k1 minus, that picks out a point in space-time, and at that point, two matter charges are sitting, L1 plus and L1 minus, and similarly for all the edges. So what the charge network does is it picks out a discrete sort of point in your space-time, and on each point you have some matter charges sitting. Next slide. There's one interesting consequence that if you look at the classical volume, which in this case is just length because circle is one dimension, then the corresponding operator is a self-adjoint operator with a discrete spectrum. And there's even a gap in the quantum theory. So and the gap is of the order of the parameter A. So we can see that at the kinematical level, we have a discreteness in quantum geometry, exactly like in LQG. Next slide. Now we come to the unitary representation of the gauge transformation. So again, recall that in loop quantum gravity, the spatial diffeomorphisms act unitarily. But basically what they do, if you take a spin network, and they just move the graph around, and everything else just goes along for the ride. In this case, situation is similar for all the constraints in parameter field theory. So once again, consider a finite canonical transformation, phi plus and phi minus, generated by the constraints. And corresponding to these two, we have two unitary operators, u hat of there's a typo. You have a plus, phi plus, and you have minus, phi minus. And I will just show the action pictorially rather than writing some equation. So next slide. So in LQG, the first picture for the LQG where it just moves the graph around and everything else moves along with it. Here, if you see what it does, if you take a phi plus, it moves the graph around. It also moves the matter charges around with the edges, but it adds 2 pi m. It does something very non-trivial to the embedding charges. It moves the charges, but it also adds 2 pi m, some 2 pi m to it. Next slide. And because there is a nice space-time picture for the charge network, there is also a nice space-time picture for the gauge transformation. So the bottom slice is the charge network, space-time picture for the charge network, S plus tensor S minus, which I just showed before. Now, if you apply a gauge transformation to it, the matter charges just move, but you add just some non-trivial additive factors to the embedding charges. So in the whole space-time, the state just moves along. So this is a space-time interpretation for the gauge transformation in our theory. Okay, next slide. So we see that there is no triangulation ambiguity in the quantization of gauge transformation, exactly like there is no ambiguity in quantization of diffeomorphisms, spatial diffeomorphisms in LQG. But what about observables? So recall that in right moving sector, observables are, if you just take y plus and you smear it with some embedding dependent function f, then you get an observable. But as we saw, y plus is not a well-defined operator in kinematic Hilbert space. So if you naively want to quantize it, what you do is, what you usually do in LQG is that you write approximate this integral by a Riemann sum, and in each term in the sum, you approximate your y plus by a holonomy operator. But eventually what happens is that you cannot remove this triangulation. In fact, it's amazing that at least for the Hamiltonian constraint, in weak star topology, you can take a triangulation to infinity and you get an operator. Although it does depend on triangulation in some very subtle way, there is an operator which is independent of a given choice of triangulation. But it doesn't happen generically for functions which depend on connection, even in LQG. Next slide. But we can define new type of observers now. Suppose we try to quantize not these OF guys, but their exponentials. Then these are very complicated functional phase space. And if you, the intermediate steps for quantization will require some choice of triangulation. However, in the end, it rather surprisingly, you can take the triangulation to infinity and a well-defined and an ambiguous operator exists. Next slide. And the action of this operator on a charge network state is as follows. So if you take this e to the IOF and you activate on this charge network state, then up to a phase factor, it doesn't change the graph, it doesn't change the embedding charges, but it adds embedding dependent values of F and to the matter charges. And you can show that these are unitary operators and they strongly commute with the gauge transformation. And again, I would like to emphasize that these observables are completely independent of any choice of triangulation. Next slide. Now what about Poincaré group? So we know that in classical theory, we thought that all the Poincaré group, all it does is it changes the embedding field, it translates the embedding field by some C numbers, delta plus and delta minus. And there's a unitary representation of this Poincaré group on our Hilbert space. And all it will do is, again, it will not change the graph, it does not change the matter charge. I will denote the unitary operators by V hat. And all it does is it changes all the embedding charges by the same amount, delta plus. And you have a similar action of V hat of delta minus on the minor Hilbert space. However, notice that all our embedding charges KEs are integral multiples of some parameter A. And so that this parameter delta plus, it cannot take arbitrary values. The theory forces it to only take integral values again. And so we have some breaking of Poincaré symmetries in this theory, which is kind of similar to what happens in lattice field theory. But notice we don't really have a lattice field theory yet. We don't even have a lattice yet. Next slide. So it's good to recap at this point. We started with a massless scalar field theory on a cylinder, and we cast into a form so that it has general covariance. In the Hamiltonian formalism, the constraint algebra turns out to be a truly algebra, which is just a feature of two dimensions. And we show that we can loop quantize theory, and we get actually two parameter family of Hilbert spaces. These are non-separable, and they carry a unitary representation of the classical gauge group. And there exists an algebra of classical observables, e to the, which are exponentials, which can be quantized without any dependence on some triangulation. And not the full Poincaré group, but a discrete subgroup of it is represented unitarily. Next slide. Now we come to how to solve the constraints. So again, recall that in LQG, the diffeomorphism constraint is solved by a technique known as group averaging. And the basic idea is very simple. Suppose you are given a spin network state. Then you take the spin network state, you look at all the states which are related to it by spatial diffeomorphism, and you look at the sum. Now, the non-triviality with the rigging map is that this sum is, of course, a distribution to begin with, but rigging map will equate the space of all these distributions with the inner product. However, notice that there's a huge amount of ambiguity in the definition of rigging map, which I've indicated by this coefficient eta subscript s. Now, we can use the same technique, because essentially our gauge transformations are spatial diffeomorphisms. We can use the same technique to solve all the constraints in our model, not just the diffeomorphism constraint. And again, I will not say anything more about the rigging map, except that there are now two, there's still a huge ambiguity in the definition of the rigging map, which is indicated by these two parameters, eta subscript s plus and eta subscript s minus. But we will see that at least for this model, we can really reduce this ambiguity quite a lot. Next slide. So we have a physical Hilbert space obtained via the rigging map, but you can show that it's non-separable. Now suppose you have a subspace of the physical Hilbert space which remains invariant under action of all the observables. So then we say that this subspace is super selected, and we can just restrict the attention to this space. Also, notice that I mentioned some technicality before that we choose A to be of the type 2 pi by n, where n is some large integer. What this tells you is that you can choose a finite sequence of embedding charges, which goes by 0, A, 2A, till, say, we take n minus 1A. We don't go after n minus 1A. We just restrict to n minus 1A. And now look at the following subspace of the kinematic Hilbert space. So you fix a graph, any graph on the circle, anything you want. And on each edge, you put a sequence of charges 0, A, till n minus 1A. So you have n edges. You fix a graph with n edges. And at least span the entire range. So this is a subspace of the Hilbert space. Now you apply a rigging map to this subspace. So you get a subspace of the physical Hilbert space. You can show that this subspace is invariant under the action of all the observables that we have and the discrete Poincaré group. And I can call this subspace HSS. Next slide. Now there are some nice things happen with this subspace. One is that it's separable, which is very nice. And the other is that if we demand that all the observables and the Poincaré symmetry should be well represented on this super HSS, then the ambiguity that I mentioned in the rigging map, so to begin with, we have an uncountable infinite number of ambiguities. They reduce to just one parameter worth of ambiguity, which is quite remarkable. So, next slide. Now we'll do physics in this super selected space. So we will argue that by working in this space, we are actually working with a lattice field theory. I'm sorry, there's a typo here. Heuristically, so we saw that as a charge network state, this correspondence should not be there. Heuristically, as a charge network, we saw it's a discrete analog of spatial space. So you have a finite number of points in your space-time, and on each point you have some matter charges sitting. And correspondingly, if you just sort of picture the physical space, which is just sum of all gauge-related states, then it will be some discrete approximation to underlying space-time. But this is a heuristic, just a pictorial way. There's a much more precise way to see it. Next slide. So you look at the algebra of observers that we have, and obviously we know that they should be well represented on our superselected space. That means two things. One is that it should map a state in HSS to a state in HSS. And the other is that suppose we assume that there is a semi-classical state in this subspace, then the expectation value of the commutator of two of these observables to leading order in H bar should be equal to the Poisson bracket. Both these conditions are satisfied if only two things happen. One is that this set of functions F, which we use to define our algebra of observables, they have to satisfy certain discrete consistency conditions. So this condition tells us that the function F for which the Dirac observables are well defined on HSS is tied to the choice of embedding charges. And even more importantly, these F have to be piecewise constant over spacing equal to A. This tells us that the test functions which generate the algebra, it cannot resolve the space-time at scale finer than A. So we interpret this as the fact that we are working with a lattice string theory. Just by looking at the algebra of observables and the test functions which define it, because the functions cannot resolve the space-time at scale finer than A, we conclude that we are working with a lattice string theory. Next slide. Now,
hello, just a second.
Yes.
A few questions here. First is that we often have this super selection in loop quantum gravity, loop quantum cosmology, etc. But there, the whole Hilbert space is decomposed into subspaces which are super selected. But here it seems to me that you just chose one subspace which is left invariant by everything. So is it not true that the whole Hilbert space can be decomposed into super-selected subspaces? And
yes, it can be, but we haven't looked at the other super-selection sector at all.
So in the LQC, for example, one knows that there are certain differences, but they are physically minor differences. If you work on one, there the super-selection sector is labeled by parameter epsilon, which goes from 0 to something, 0 to 4. And then one can work with any sector, but some sector is easier to work with. So here you are saying that you are similarly focusing on one sector.
Well, the thing is that if you look at any super selected sector where the embedding charges are different on each successive edge, then on all such sectors, the rigging map ambiguities really come down drastically, exactly the way I showed here.
Uh-huh.
But if you work with some super-selected sector where say two embedding charges are same, but matter charges are different, then we haven't examined it, but we don't know if the rigging map ambiguities come down as drastically as it does for these super-selection sectors. So that is one reason we are working with this one.
Okay. And the second set of questions is really what we had in the last transparency, which is 34. To begin with, you had this complete set of observables which are parameterized by this F. Right? Basically, F is a test field, and then you are using it as a smearing field for the derivatives of the physical scalar field. And the derivatives of the physical scalar fields are observables, and therefore these are smeared observables. Okay.
Yes.
But so far, this smearing field was left arbitrary. And everything you have said so far works perfectly fine with an arbitrary F. But now you are asked, and if you just wanted to know that this operator is well defined, then I suppose that operator is going to be well defined on the super selection sector for all F. Isn't that true? Because that is how you define the super selection sector, by saying that look at the subspace of the whole Hilbert space, which is less invariant by all the observables.
Obviously this F has to be such that F of KE has to be, there is an extra condition on F that F of KE for all edges have to be integral multiple of epsilon, because this F of K is being added to LE when the operator acts. So that condition implicitly goes in his choice of the function. It's a very weak condition because the left cell continues.
That you have put in the very beginning in some way, right? I mean, that condition on F is put in the very beginning. So that is not a restriction. So let's begin with X to satisfy that condition, and that is a complete set, right? Of observables. Yeah. So we have got a complete set of observables. And so this complete set of observables is automatically represented or well defined on the superselected sector. And so it seems to me that the real assumption is number two, that there should be semi-classical state in the sense that you have defined.
I agree.
Okay, so if the real assumption is number two, then this discreteness, in a curious way, is coming by looking at semi-classical states, or semi-classical, not semi-classical states, but requiring that your sector admit a good semi-classical interpretation.
Yes.
So it's a bit curious, right? Because you might have thought that semi-classical considerations actually would not bring out discreteness. Somehow it is really pure quantum considerations. That corresponds to
the reason it happens is the following. If you look at the commutator between these two observables, you look at the expectation value in any state, then you pick up a phase factor. And the exponent in the phase factor is a Riemann sum. If you look at the Poisson bracket between two observables, and it also gives you sort of a phase factor where the exponent is an integral. Now, when we take expectation values, these are just C numbers, they are not operators, so the expectation value will not do anything to the phase factor. So these two have to exactly match for the semi-classical considerations to hold, the phase factor coming from the Poisson bracket and the phase factor coming from the commutator. But that will only happen when the Riemann sum is equal to the integral. And that only happens if these functions are piecewise constant. That's why, but I agree that it's exactly the semi-classical consideration which will give you the second condition.
May I make a comment, Sabah?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so the algebra which is well represented is the kinematical one. And in LQG, of course, we don't have the analog of observables. Here there is an unambiguous construction of observables, but then one has to go and check as to what the algebra is. And if you just compute the algebra of operators, this commutator algebra, you really don't get anything. You just get, some operator which acts on states. It doesn't really have much to do with the Poisson bracket algebra. And if you require it to have something to do with the Poisson bracket algebra, then that is where these functions become discrete. So that was the only other comment. There's a distinction between the kinematic algebra, which is well represented, and then something happens on the algebra of physical observables. And if you want these to actually have something to do with classical theory, then you get the space-time discreteness.
Yeah, but I agree. But still, the statement is that the non-trivial condition is coming from asking that you have a semi-classical sector.
Yes, precisely.
In the physical, as Madhavan clarified just now, for the physical observables, not just the kinematical sector, you want some semi-classical interpretation to be there, and that is telling you that there should be actually some fundamental discreteness. Okay.
Yes. Okay, so now we go on to slide 35. So it turns out that when we work with the superselected space, even some very nice things happen with the Poincaré invariance. So recall that these parameters which go into the definition of Poincaré group in quantum theory, they have to be multiples of A. But so let's take delta plus to be equal to A, exactly equal to A. Let's take a state in a superselected subspace, which I have denoted by eta acting on kinematical state. And let's apply the unitary operator corresponding to this Poincaré translation on this state. And it turns out that what you get on the right hand side is just that the matter charges get cyclically permuted. There's a cyclic permutation on the matter charges, and nothing at all happens to the graph or the embedding charges. In other words, the action of V hat operator on a physical state is same as a physical state with cyclically permuted matter charges. So what this tells you is that if you take a state psi in your superselected space, which is invariant under cyclic permutation of matter charges, then the physical state will be Poincaré invariant. But we can construct infinite number of states like these. So in other words, in this theory, there are infinite number of Poincaré invariant states, which is very very different from a Fock space where you have exactly one Poincaré invariant state, which is the vacuum state. Next slide. So now we come.
Alok, and these are all physical Hilbert. I mean, in the physical Hilbert space, there are many. Yeah.
Yes. So now we come to the final part of my talk, which is how do we recover continuum theory. So as I argued, we are working on lattice field theory, but finally we want to recover the classical theory, which is a continuum theory. Now, we also know that physically the theory that we are working with is just a free scalar field theory on flat space time, and parameterized. General covariance is just fake. So the free scalar field theory on flat space time can also be quantized on Fock space. And we know that Fock vacuum is a canonical semi-classical state because it's a coherent state. So the question that we want to ask is that can we define a suitable approximant to Fock vacuum in the physical, in the super-selected space, that physical Hilbert space that we are in? And so far the only information we have is the following. That we know that the Fock space is scale invariant. It doesn't depend on any escapes like epsilon away. So we can expect that the approximation that we will have will become better as epsilon and A go to zero. And of course, our state candidate Fock state should be Poincaré invariant because the Fock vacuum is Poincaré invariant. Next slide. Now here how we frame the question. We know that Fock vacuum requires a notion of creation and annihilation operators. But these are not well-defined operators in our theory. The only operators which are well-defined, the only observables which are well-defined are some exponentials. So first thing we have to do is find a suitable approximant to the creation and annihilation operators. Then and remember we have a two-parameter family of Hilbert spaces. So we look for a two-parameter family of states, one state in each of these Hilbert spaces, such that, and this state psi has to satisfy the following condition, that if you take the annihilation operators, which I call A at n, then it has to give you 0 plus some error terms for all n which are much less than 2 pi by A. And by error term, I mean this term should be such that in the limit epsilon A go to 0, this term should vanish. If we do find such a state, then we can say that it approximates Fock vacuum for long wavelength modes of the scalar field. Next slide. Now, the way you find suitable approximants to An is as follows. An classically is nothing but integral of y, it's an observable. So it's an integral of y plus x with e to the I and x plus x. So first thing we do is, but remember we have a lattice now. So first thing we do is we discretize this guy, and we approximate the discrete expression by operators. This is the only place really where we will need a choice of triangulation. And let me just tell you what the candidate Fock vacuum is. The form is as follows. There's a Gaussian sort of weight factor. We are summing over all possible matter configurations. And of course, we are in the super selected space, so the graph is fixed and the embedding charges are fixed. And I'm not explicitly telling you what F is. It's some complicated function, but it's a positive definite function of the matter charges, and it's invariant under the cyclic permutation. And that's why this psi is Poincaré invariant. And here's what the continuum limit is. So the best way to understand the continuum limit is as follows. You fix the two parameters, epsilon naught and A naught, once and for all. And consider epsilon going to zero, rapid more faster than A. So it goes as written there. If you take the continuum limit in this way, then it turns out that this state psi approximates the Fock vacuum better and better in the limit A goes to zero. I'll come back to this point in the next slide, but the computation involved here are very complicated, and unfortunately I know of no intuitive or physical way to understand this limit. The only thing I can say is that it works. Next slide. So let me note some interesting features first. One is, which I already pointed out, that this state is Poincaré invariant, as it should be. And as we take the continuum limit, as epsilon may go to zero, non-trivial contributions to A hat n of psi only come from larger and larger charges. In other words, the charges which satisfy this condition, epsilon by A times L, remain finite. So as epsilon A go to zero, and as because epsilon is going to zero faster than A, only larger and larger charges non-trivially contribute. And then there are some highly delicate cancellations between these non-trivial contributions so that the leading order term is zero. another thing to note is that if you look at the expectation value of the commutator AHN and AHM dagger in the state size, then it exactly matches what you would expect. The leading order, it gives you the Poisson brackets. Again, for all N and M, which are much less than, I'm sorry, there's a typo here, which are much less than 2 pi by A. This fact is not actually very surprising, because the Y algebra of the Y plus piece was faithfully represented on the kinematical hyperspace. This is just a reflection of that statement. And now I come back to the point that why I don't really understand what this limit is. Because we do not have any physical interpretation of the matrix charges, at least. In the sense that they are not eigenvalues of any... we know that K is an eigenvalue of the embedding operators, but these LEs are not eigenvalues of any commuting set of operators. Next slide. So let me just summarize now. Two-dimensional parameter field theory, the model that we looked at here, it's a perfect field theoretic model in the sense that the entire program of loop quantization can be completed. We have solved all the constraints, we have an unambiguous algebra of observables, and we can also define a continuum limit in a precise way. And all our constructions, quantization of gauge transformations and quantization of algebra of observables is free of any choice of triangulation. And we have a physical hyperspace with a very small ambiguity in the definition of the rigging map or the physical planar product. And this point is important to notice that due to super selection and also, what I said, because of the fact that we require the super selected sector to have a semi-classical scale, the final quantum theory that we get is a theory of scale of field operators living on a lattice. It's a regular lattice with lattice spacing being small k. And there exists a state size which in a precise sense approximates a Fock vacuum for long wavelength modes of the scalar of field. Next slide. And there are a number of things one can try now. One thing is one can try to do the same parameter field here on R2 instead of on a cylinder. Because what happens on R2 is that if you look at this embedding field, then they have to satisfy some non-trivial asymptotic conditions. And that's a very nice toy model for LQG or non-compact spaces, because there the triads have to satisfy non-trivial boundary conditions. And also this model is actually canonically related to the CGHS module. We can also look at the path integral formulation for parametric field theory. There's already a continuum path integral formulation, and there the measure factor is actually exact analog of Fuzzy Popov measure Farkin-Wilkowski measure for quantum gravity. So what we can do is we can describe this path integral and get a sort of spin form representation for parametric field theory. And we know from this work that there's already a physical inner product. So we can compare the spin form representation with the physical inner product that we have here. Also, what we did here was we didn't do Dirac quantization. We quantized the flow generated by the constraint. But one could do Dirac quantization with either the constraint or a master constraint, and we could see how different physical hyperspaces compare. I will end here. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks very much, Alok. We have time for questions, comments, so please ask questions.
Hi, this is Benjamin Barr from Gorham. I have a question. Can you please tell us a bit more about the precise sense in which the physical Hilbert space is non-separable? This seems a bit confusing.
Does the physical Hilbert space? Yeah, well, the physical Hilbert space is non-separable because the set of our graphs is non-separable.
Sorry, I didn't get you. Yes, there's the physical Hilbert space, which is non-separable.
Yes, the physical Hilbert space is non-separable because the family of graphs, if you don't fix a graph, you look at all possible graphs.
Benjamin, is your confusion coming from the general things that people often say that in loop quantum gravity, physical space is separable? Is that your source of confusion?
Yes. I mean, if one chooses the diffeomorphism group sufficiently large, then all the moduli, for instance, at the vertices vanishes, and the solution to the diffeomorphism constraint, at least, is separable. So that's why I was confused.
Yeah, but here the diffeomorphism group is just, we are just looking at analytic diffeomorphism. So, I mean, we haven't investigated it further, but we didn't really enlarge the diffeomorphism group. So, that's why I think that it might be non-separable, but it's not something we have really looked at. Because finally, we work with a separable space, which is the superselector space.
It is the moduli, basically, the equivalent of the moduli in loop quantum gravity.
Yeah, exactly. But it might might be right, because there might be no moduli in one dimension. I'm not sure, because we haven't really looked at it. But our intuition is that if you look at all possible graphs, then you will just still have a non-separable Hilbert space if you do not enlarge your gauge group.
Yeah, because even in full loop quantum gravity, it really depends sensitively on what diffeomorphisms you allow. If you just allow this piecewise analytic diffeomorphisms as opposed to homeomorphisms. Yeah. Okay. So let me ask a few questions, and then I'm sure that other people also have questions. So if I just looked at your physical Hilbert space and your physical theory, then there are several very nice things that are happening. The first is that if you start at the classical level, then you have disguised this theory as a generally covariant theory.
Yes,
but
yes.
There is a preferred subgroup, namely the Poincaré group. And somehow you found that the Poincaré group is naturally sort of separated out as a group of symmetries rather than a gauge group.
Yes, yes.
So this, to me, is extremely attractive because, and again, particularly in the asymptotically flat case, one might want to say that one says that all the time in classical general relativity that the diffeomorphisms which are asymptotically identity have to be thought of as gauge, the ones which are asymptotically Poincaré have to be thought of as symmetries. And so your formulation with these embedding variables and something somehow magically seems to be able to tell the difference between something that should be regarded, a huge thing that should be regarded as a gauge, and some physically a smaller thing which is physically interesting to be regarded as symmetry. So that might be very useful, I think.
Yes, but I mean, that happens in classical cases that there are observables in the classical theory. I did not talk about them, but there are observables in the classical theory which actually generate this conformal, in fact, the full conformal group. And so that's why they're symmetry, because they will map solutions to solutions.
Right, and the same thing is true in the asymptotically flat context and full general relativity. There are observables, namely the total energy momentum, angular momentum, which do that. So that's why the analogy is very good. But so this is all very, very nice. But then I don't have good understanding of your physical Hilbert space, even after super selection. You've got these infinitely many Poincaré invariant states. So what does this theory look like? I mean, I have no idea. How can you compare it with? If I just not know anything about parameterized field theory, I would just build a Fock space. So you're telling us that in some limit, the standard Fock vacuum is recovered. So one might say that standard Fock vacuum is an idealization, and normally we don't have that. If you don't take that limit, then we won't have that. But I would have thought that somehow, even at the discrete level, you don't have kind of infinitely more things than you have in the continuum limit. So you're somehow saying that in the continuum limit, all these invariant, Poincaré invariant states degenerate into a single one? Is that what you're saying?
No. The most of the Poincaré invariant states will not be semi-classical. So we haven't shown uniqueness, but the way we did our computations, if you require a Poincaré invariant state to approximate Fock vacuum, then it sort of seems to uniquely pick out these wave factors, which are the Gaussian type of wave factors. But most of the other Poincaré invariant states will not be semi-classical. So there will just be some different phase of the theory here.
So the statement is that this is what I'm trying to still understand. So even your physical Hilbert space is kind of much bigger or much richer or something in some heuristic sense.
Exactly, yes.
Than the Fock space that we have. And you're saying that it itself has many sectors. And some ways, I could consider, this is what I'm trying to understand. I could consider, say, one parameter family of states, which in the limit gives you the Fock vacuum. In fact, that's how you constructed it, actually.
Yes.
So would I say that at the finite value of the parameter, without taking the limit going to zero,
yes,
that in fact, take this state, which is quote-unquote preferred pointer invariant state, if you like, and do a GNS construction on it, would I get a Hilbert space which is smaller than your superselected physical Hilbert space?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't done that, but yeah, I think so, yes. It's something we have not done, though.
Right, so maybe that is physically called for, right? I mean, because then one would say that, well, in other words, one has to sharpen this, but I think your idea that somehow things should admit semi-classical limit, that could be strengthened. And if we could strengthen it, then maybe there is actually even a subsector of your physical Hilbert space, which really corresponds to the, which one would like to take seriously as a candidate for the loop quantum gravity description of the parameterized field theory. Namely, there are many sectors in which classical limit doesn't, there are no semi-classical states in some strong sense, but there is this sector of the superselected, of your current superselected sector, a subsector of your current superselected sector, that may come out as shining, that one should consider.
Yes.
Okay, other questions, comments? Let me ask two quick questions. The first is that you several times said that the algebra is a truly algebra, constraint algebra is a truly algebra only in two dimensions. Is this something that you know that it will not be in higher dimensions, or what is this? I'm not sure about.
If you take any field theory in say four dimensions or three dimensions even, you can always introduce general covariance in exactly the same way that P has. And then the constraint algebra will just be the Dirac algebra. It will have structure functions, which will depend on the embedding variables. It's only in two dimensions that basically what you are getting is just the width algebra, the Virasoro algebra with samples are zero.
Okay, so then to some extent then one should not be too excited about these two dimensional results, because you did use this fact in your detailed calculation.
Yes. Right? That's very much, yeah.
Okay. And then the second thing is about the conformal group. So classically the symmetry group was a conformal group.
Right.
And now, you did not have time to talk about it, but the statement is the statement that on your superselected Hilbert space, there is a symmetry group, which is not just a Poincare group, but the entire conformal group. Is that what you're saying?
No. We have a one parameter family of Hilbert spaces, two parameter family of Hilbert spaces, which depend on this non-trivial scale A. And this non-zero A value indicates that you will only recover the conformal group in the limit that A exactly goes to zero. Otherwise, the conformal group, so in each of these polymer Hilbert spaces, the conformal group remains broken.
Well, that's physically how one would expect.
Yeah.
And the last thing is that you sort of started with the zero mode and you just forgot about it. Can you say something?
I unfortunately did not talk about it, but there's a consistent way to freeze the zero mode. So you want to put the zero mode momentum equal to zero, which is an extra first class constraint in the theory. So you have to again do a group averaging to take care of the zero mode. It does not change anything qualitatively. It introduces some quantitative complication, but everything that I said here just basically goes through.
Okay. Last chance for various questions, please. Okay, if not, let us thank Alok again. Thank you, Alok and Madhavan. Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye.